You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 3rd, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sonia Shaw, saying it's time to tell a new story of coronavirus. Meanwhile, 155,000 are dead, and Deborah Birx concedes the U.S. coronavirus is extraordinarily widespread. Meanwhile, one-third of New York City's small businesses are gone for good, and 30 million people just lost $2,400 a month. And Republican lawmakers apparently have no incentive to help them. Meanwhile, Trump sidelines the CDC and tasks the Pentagon with non-existent vaccine distribution. And TikTok, Microsoft has 45 days to buy it. Trump assaults the 2020 census and the U.S. Post Office. Feds leave Portland. Protests turn peaceful. GOP convention bans journalists. Joe Biden polling well in North Carolina and Georgia. And the Democrats warn McConnell. Seat a new Supreme Court justice, and we will pack the court. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. It is Monday. Thanks for joining us. Hope you had a good weekend. More of the same in many respects. The coronavirus continues. We're hearing more about outbreaks that are flaring up in Europe. And of course, in this country, numbers are more or less stabilizing, but becoming more widespread in some ways. I'm also very skeptical about the stabilization of these numbers. I'm skeptical, but I haven't heard anybody who's an expert on this actually look into this stuff at all. And maybe we will ask Sonia Shaw about this. I don't know that she would have information on it, but it does seem weird to me that things leveled off literally the day after the CDC stops getting the numbers and the White House gets them first.
Yeah, we just started vetting them.
I mean, you know, like, it sounds very conspiratorial to say that, but it also sort of sounds sort of obvious in some ways. But who knows? But nevertheless, we do have 155,000 dead. We are hitting death toll numbers like we haven't seen since May. And there are reports of problems in schools in Georgia. One school system got hit hard. I think it was
Gwinnett County.
In Gwinnett County, yep. And we're, you know, I imagine, certainly been my experience, the only thing that I'm talking about with people right now is like, should we send the kids to school? Should they do the hybrid or the, well, obviously they're going to attend school, but the question is should they do the hybrid model in New York or should they do the remote only? And if they do the hybrid model for the first like couple of weeks and then they go remote lonely only, are they going to be lonely? But also, is it going to put them behind the eight ball because they've shifted over into another sort of, I guess, parallel track? There's, and of course, you know, like a lot of parenting, there is no, you have, they're not in any way qualified to make any of these decisions. I don't know that anybody is, frankly, but there it is. So that's where we're at. And meanwhile, waiting on Joe Biden to pick a running mate. Polling looks pretty good. And in Washington, the Republican Senate has basically skipped town. And Mnuchin is essentially negotiating with Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats on behalf of Donald Trump. Although, according to Steve Mnuchin, Donald Trump is intimately involved in the negotiations regarding in what manner can we screw the workers and, more broadly speaking, the American public during the course of this pandemic. There's a lot of new data that has come out now that we are just past this is the first day where, I mean, I think people got their checks prior to Friday, but their last checks prior to Friday. But we have 63%, something to that effect, 65%, somewhere around that number, of people were actually making more on unemployment than they were during, you know, in terms of their actual wages. And it was keeping the economy afloat. It was obviously, it was keeping them in their homes or their apartments, their houses. That has gone away for tens of millions of people. And all the money, the extra $2,400 has gone away for 30 million people. So do the math, folks. That is, those people are done spending any money. They are now going to get evicted. And all the data shows that there is no correlation between getting that extra money, or let me put it this way, no significant correlation between getting that extra money and not returning to work. There's been multiple studies on this now. And there's some tiny marginal correlation, but so what? All right, so let's play this clip from Steve Mnuchin, who says that Trump is incredibly involved.
Do you think the president needs to be more involved this weekend?
President's incredibly involved, so let me
but
just
he's
say.
But he's been golfing this weekend, sir. Do you think he needs to hold a meeting here at the White House? Does he need to be involved in these talks?
I think Mark and I spoke to the president something like 8 or 10 times yesterday. The president, wherever he is available around the clock for us. I spoke to him very late last night. I'll be speaking to him again this morning. The president is fully available.
I'm intimately involved for... He's literally on the golf course and they're calling him.
Just communications technology means you're on the clock all the time now. This is like when you hear like billionaires talk about how they work 80 hours a week and like they're counting when they're in the back of being chauffeured around answering emails as work.
Right. Right. I was on my yacht and I'm still like, if somebody's got a call whether we should buy those shares, I got to answer the phone and say yes. Constantly, constantly working. That is hilarious. I don't know. I don't know if I should be terrified by that or what. Meanwhile, as you know, folks, hiring can be difficult. But if you're a company that's currently looking to hire, you got new difficulties. How do you safely open your doors? How do you find the right person? Product Fulfillment Solutions was one such company. They needed to hire an organized, detailed-oriented executive assistant, so they turned to ZipRecruiter. I've talked about ZipRecruiter for years. I've used ZipRecruiter. Brendan's here because of ZipRecruiter. They got to do an ad about me. Tired of talking about other companies. We did this. But Product Fulfillment Solutions, they did it during this pandemic. They turned to ZipRecruiter. And they have their ZipRecruiter has a powerful matching technology. It finds people with the right skills and experience for your job. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. We were one of those 4. Well, I mean, obviously there's more than 4, but we were one of those 80% of employers who did that. But I held out. That's how we got Brendan. But that's also how Product Fulfillment Solutions found Christina Rumbaletti for their executive assistant role. Christina lost her job during COVID-19, so she created a profile on ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter identified her as a great match for the Product Fulfillment Solutions role and sent them her profile. Then the CEO reached out to Christina, invited her to apply to the job. She applied, quickly became a top candidate. 2 days later, she was hired. Zip, zang, bing, boom. ZipRecruiter helped Christina find the right job, and they help Product Fulfillment Solutions find the right person for their role fast. See how ZipRecruiter can help you hire. Try it now for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. I cannot guarantee you will find someone as skilled as Brendan, so perfectly suited for this show as Brendan. But it worked for us, so we got Brendan.
Just swimming in an algorithm river over here.
That's right. We cast in the right direction. Folks, I think you know that I'm a little bit sartorially challenged. I'm much less so these days. I also don't like to go to places to shop. And these days, who does? But how can you be sure that you're getting the right size? How can you be sure that you're getting what you like? Stitch Fix. It's a personal styling company. It makes getting the clothes you love effortless. It's a completely different way to shop. It's all about you every single time. To get started, go to stitchfix.com/majority. You set up your profile. Then they deliver you great looks personalized just for you in your colors, styles, and budget. You pay a $20 styling fee, but it is credited towards anything you keep in this box of stuff they send you. You can schedule at any time. There's no subscription required. Shipping, returns, exchanges, they're easy and they're free. Stitch Fix does all the hard work for you, making great style effortless for everybody, including men, women, and kids. I got some of my favorite shoes, these leather chukkas. Are they chukkas or chukkas? We go through this every time, Brendan. I can't remember what it is. But
I say chukka. But
they're chukkas. They're the most stylish shoe I own. And I got a great straight fit pant, which I've been wearing the heck out of, from Flag and Anthem. I had never heard of them before, but and Mila absconded my flannel shirt. But you go in, you tell them what kind of brands you like, what kind of looks you like. I don't like logos on my thing and blah, 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 all this, all my weird idiosyncrasies about clothing. And then they send back like ideas for you and send you out a box. And if you don't like any of them, you send it back. If you like all of them, you keep it. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. Stitchfix.com/majority. Great way to update your wardrobe without having to go out and shop. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And do we have her, Brendan?
Yeah, she's going to call in momentarily.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe we should just wait until we definitely have her on. So Deborah Birx basically came out, and she is the lead, I guess, authority in the Trump White House for dealing with coronavirus. And apparently she and Fauci, and I don't know, Fauci's like been sort of relegated to the back seats, have warned 20 states in the Sun Belt, the Midwest, and the Pacific Northwest that the virus spread is accelerating within their borders. Sunday, there were 478 deaths that were tallied, down from 566 reported the same day last week. However, Texas hadn't even reported at that point, and they had nearly 300 deaths a day. So I think it's pretty big, the numbers. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Sonia Shaw. She is a journalist and author of Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, as well as the next migration. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Sonia Shaw. She's an independent investigative journalist and author of Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, as well as The Next Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move, and a piece in The Nation magazine. It's time to tell a new story about coronavirus. In that piece... And here we are, Sonia, with 155,000 dead. We haven't, not only have we not seemed to contained the virus, we have not in any way seemed to like have made any progress in conceptualizing how we might contain it. There doesn't seem to be an effort. Like, it's barely accepted that it existed, that exists as far as the White House is concerned. Tell us, like, what is the story that we are telling ourselves about coronavirus? And frankly, I think you would argue pandemics more broadly speaking.
Well, I think the story we've been telling is that this is something that is fairly simple to repel if we just had the right drug or vaccine, if we just had the right sort of biomedical commodity, and we just need to kind of quickly create one and use that as a weapon against this invasive germ that's sort of encroaching upon us from foreign bodies and foreign lands. And, you know, I think that plays itself out in a lot of different ways, but the most deadly way is that it makes us minimize our own role. And so rather than thinking of this as something, well, we have to change our behaviors. We have to change our collective behaviors in order to minimize the spread of this virus between us, in order to, you know, reduce the risk that a virus like this would emerge in the first place. You know, we don't really think about all that stuff because we just say, oh, a new virus, like, let's like quickly get a new drug, get a new vaccine, and we'll just, you know, hang tight until we have these new sort of biomedical commodities to save us. And I think what we're seeing already is that that's not enough. You know, we already have 150,000 people dead, and the vaccine is nowhere to be seen. And whether we get one in, you know, October or next year, it's a huge death toll we're going to face before we have any such tools. And then, of course, there's all the other questions about whether that vaccine will really save us. You know, I mean, I think there's real questions to be asked about that as well.
All right. So, I mean, we have like, I mean, there's there's two subsets, it seems to me, of the paradigm that you're talking about. One is sort of how we should behave or behave. One is how we should structure our societies to be more resilient for something like this. And then the other is how do we address this in, you know, now that it's here, right? I mean, those are the two sort of like, it seems to me, two sort of, I guess, silos of responses to this. One of the things that occurs to me is that, you know, I've spoken to epidemiologists who are like, you know, 6 months after the first peak, it comes back in a second peak. And I'm becoming very much convinced that that is not a function of the virus as much as a function of human beings, like getting overconfident or not taking it seriously. I mean, so let's focus first on the question of like, with a new paradigm, how do we address this from this point forward?
Well, I think the way we address this is to really put on at the foreground of our efforts, the absolute highest priority is behavior change, is changing the way the virus is allowed to spread between us because it's exploiting human behaviors. So how do we do that? Do we spend billions of dollars developing a vaccine and throwing money at drug companies? Or do we spend all of that money trying to figure out through social science and anthropology and psychology, how much money do you have to give to a single mom so she can stay home and not go to work if, you know, if it endangers her life? How much support do you have to give to a school in order to make it safe and reduce transmission opportunities inside that school? You know, all of those things that we're kind of talking about in, you know, a really a half-baked way, in a sort of, you know, very dismissive fashion where we're not really throwing nearly enough resources or attention to it. Those are the things that should be as important, more important than the race for the vaccine. You know, so there's so many questions we're not even asking. We don't even know, like, for example, what is the effective dose? So we don't know how much virus do you need to be exposed to in order to get sick. Right. We don't really know what that is because that's not a priority question for us. Right. If we knew that, then we would know what kinds of behaviors are most risky. We have a very crude understanding of that right now. So what I'm saying is we need to think of this as something that is about human behavior. It's not about the evil germ that we have to kill with, you know, some killing chemical. It's about how we spread it. And so that means we need to all get together and think really carefully and spend our resources figuring out how can we reshape our society so that this thing can't spread as quickly between us.
I read an interview with you that you gave in January. I think it was like right towards the end of January. And it is, it's a little bit eerie. I mean, you seem to know stuff then about the virus that our government didn't seem to even acknowledge as late as like April or May. I mean, I guess the point of what you're saying on some level is that like we are making choices and we are not conscious of the choices that we are making. We're sort of like backing into them, or people who are making these choices for us are doing it on the basis of something other than how do we deal with coronavirus.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I don't think it's just me. I mean, I think if you know, the whole reason I was able to write a book about pandemics, about how microbes turn into pandemic causing pathogens and cause all this death and disruption, is because so much is known. We know how this happens, right? We know where these microbes originate from. We know how they spill over into human populations. We know how they spread between us, and we know what it takes to vanquish them. We've done it many times in the past. And the way we have vanquished new pathogens in the past is not through a magic bullet drug or a wonder shot. It's just not. You know, that is not what the history has shown. The way we have conquered malaria, cholera, tuberculosis, typhoid, any number of pathogens that used to take thousands and thousands of lives in Western countries for decades and centuries was through social reform. It was not because we came up with some fancy new vaccine or antibiotic. In fact, the most success we've ever had taming a pathogen with a vaccine was with smallpox. And that vaccine was based on, you know, centuries old folk remedies that were common in Asia and Africa. So it wasn't a high tech product. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, the drugs and vaccines that the pharmaceutical industry provides for us are not useful. They're hugely useful, but they're not useful in taming a pathogen when it is, you know, newly emerged and causing an epidemic. It's those things work when you have those things, those problems under control already, and they kind of keep it down to a low level if you use them correctly. But to have a huge outbreak like we're having now and to expect like a single vaccine to suddenly come and save us is just, it's fantasy. It's an ahistorical idea.
It's ahistorical. What do you think the incentive structures are to frame it that way? I mean, is it simply because, is it a combination of humans have a pretty poor imagination, or is it a combination of that and humans have a pretty poor imagination when they stand to profit in not imagining?
I mean, I think it's partially that. It's also just an artifact of our history. So we had kind of tamed a lot of the really bad pathogens that used to plague us through, you know, clean water and sanitation and rules around like food contamination and better housing. You know, all of those things really tamed a lot of pathogens that used to, you know, cause pandemics and epidemics in the past. And then we came up with antibiotics and vaccines. And, you know, we had this evidence-based medicine that really we, you know, heroized, and we decided, well, that those things are what saved us. And it really, we trained, you know, indoctrinated several generations of Americans into believing that infectious diseases were a thing of the past. And these were things that you could easily control. It's just an infection. Get a course of antibiotics. It's $30 or $40, right? That kind of rhetoric tells you all of it right there. We don't say, oh, it's just cancer, you know, get some chemotherapy, because we know cancer is a big problem. You got to do a lot of different things to deal with it, right? Well, infectious diseases can be a big problem too. They're complex. And we're seeing when we have these new diseases where we don't have, you know, something off the shelf that we can use, whether it's Zika or Ebola or any number of the new pathogens we're seeing today, including coronavirus, that we don't have something readily available and we can't make it fast enough. So then what do you do, right? Then what happens? The way we've been trained has sort of divorced us from that reality that we lived with for many centuries before this.
Are there countries that are doing this correctly at this point? I mean, you know, over the weekend, it seemed like there were new problems that were developing in different countries in Europe. Now, I think their definition of what a problem is relative to ours, mm-hmm. I think is they seem to be much more sensitive about it. Like they're ringing the alarm bells. When, you know, for something that, you know, we would be like, oh, great, we can just send people to school, you know, no problem, open up
right,
everything.
Right,
I mean,
right.
They have different set of standards, but, 'cause this, at the end of the day, the virus is just not going to walk away at one point because people are doing the right thing. But are there models out there that you think are particularly successful?
I mean, I think all of those countries that are having minor eruptions that are then quickly contained, that's the best you can hope for, right? Like you can't have zero. That's not a realistic goal. So you can't have zero, but can you get in front of it so that when I think of it as like a fire, you know, can you contain it when it's still an ember, when it's still just a spark? Or are you waiting for a bonfire and then you're smelling the smoke from 10 miles away and then you're coming and dealing with it? That's what we're doing in the United States. We're smelling the smoke, you know, and we don't know where the fire is. And by the time we recognize that it's happening, it's already huge. And then, you know, then we have to take very crude measures, or we pretend it's not happening, or, you know, any number of the sort of chaotic responses that we're seeing. But in these other countries, you know, they're getting ahead of it. So they are screening, they are doing surveillance, they know where those sparks and embers are. And as soon as they start to ignite a little bit, they go and they, you know, put the fire out. So that is the best case scenario. The fact that we're talking about it in the same way is just indicative of our lack of understanding about how this pandemic is going to unfold, that you're not going to be in a place where there's zero cases and zero introductions. As long as the virus exists in the world anywhere, it's going to come into different places because we are highly mobile. Whether we're crossing international borders or not, we are moving around and we are interacting with each other because we're humans and that's what we do. So, you know, we're talking about it all in the same breath as if, oh, well, South Korea had a little outbreak now, so they're not doing so well either. That's just totally the wrong way to think about it. You know, what we should be looking at is a way, you know, the cases per 100,000, like something where you can compare apples to apples. And then I think you'll be more clear that what they're doing is they're getting out in front of it. What we're doing is completely reactive if we're doing anything at all.
Right. It is just that they are far more sensitive to these things than we seem to be. Because, and that is part and parcel of why they're doing a better job of this. Let's break down the sort of the where we can see our, not just our lab, because what you're talking about is perceiving coronavirus and pathogens like this as something that is, you know, no silver bullet is going to deal this. We need to sort of have almost like a wellness approach as a society heading into this. But before we get to sort of that full-on idea, give me a sense of how these other societies, for the most part, also are better situated to deal with these things than we are, right? I mean, both as like they have mechanisms so that they can pay people. Like even if we decided tomorrow, for whatever reason, the Republicans said like, yeah, we're going to do a, you know, regular payments, not just for unemployment, but we're going to do it for everybody or something to that effect. We don't really have a very good mechanism for it. We didn't have a particularly good mechanism for it in terms of the paycheck protection program. Other societies have better mechanisms for this and for delivery of healthcare. Give me a sense of how, like what you think would be different in this country if by fluke, we just had a more robust healthcare system in terms of, you know, I want to say if we had Medicare for all, you know, 10 years ago, but if we did, we'd probably be a different society that would have reacted to all of this very differently anyway. So it's sort of hard to say that exactly. In terms of like, you know, if we had wings, we'd be flying, but give me a sense of how it would work. I mean, just from a, forget the sort of like the personality of the country and our disposition. If we had that physical, if aliens had imposed Medicare for all on us, you know, grudgingly 3 years ago, how would we be different? What things would be different from a practical standpoint?
I think we would, you know, we already do this, right? So this is, I don't think this is like controlling this pandemic. I don't think that's somehow, you know, alien to our system. Like we do this all the time in public health in this country and we do it successfully. We have little outbreaks of say measles or, you know, chickenpox or HIV or syphilis or, you know, there's all these other pathogens that we have little outbreaks, you know, here and there. We do surveillance. Doctors let, you know, the CDC know and their state health departments know. And we do exactly what we're talking about trying to do with coronavirus, which is testing, and socially, you know, supported isolation, contact tracing and isolation. Those are things that work. That's just a regular tool of public health. We've been doing it in this country for a long time. We just have completely failed to do it with this one. I don't think there's any structural reason why we couldn't do it. I think it's the reason we're not doing it is it's absolutely political. You know, it was a political choice that our leadership made. Because whether it was incompetence or just a lack of understanding or because they thought it was politically useful for them to try to ignore it and make it into a fight. You know, whatever the reason is, and, you know, we'll be talking and figuring that out for probably years to come. But what could we have controlled this with our existing infrastructure? Yes, because we would have done it much earlier. It wouldn't have become such a huge problem where you need 300,000 contact tracers. You know, that's what we need now. That's what we need now because we have so many cases because there's so much virus just in the community across the whole country. But if we had responded in January and February when, you know, when this thing was first coming out and when the WHO sounded the alarm And we had a system in place here. We had a plan. We had a pandemic plan team that was, you know, installed at the very highest echelons of our government. We have a public health system. It's not as robust as in other countries, but it's certainly up to the task if you have a new virus and it's not everywhere all at once, you know. So we could have activated that and it could have worked. But now we're in a totally different situation because now we have so much virus that it's completely overwhelmed the capacity that we had, even if we have the political will to actually use it, which we don't.
So when we tell a different story of coronavirus, are we really, I mean, has the ship sailed here? I mean, you know, I don't anticipate, you know, we're watching now a Republican Congress who it appears to me have basically said, we got the things we wanted most urgently, which was corporate, basically a corporate line of credit for as long as the eye can see. It propped up the stock market, and the rest of it, we just don't feel that much of an urgency about. So we're not going to do anything. We're probably going to lose the election anyways. So this is going to become Joe Biden's problem. Meanwhile, the Democrats are out there and they're, you know, what they're pushing for is some of it is good. States, municipalities are definitely going to need money. But, you know, subsidizing COBRA, that's a huge waste. I mean, it's couldn't be more inefficient. They're not talking about things like the post office and whatnot. I know that doesn't directly deal with coronavirus, but even if Joe Biden becomes president, he's becoming president 6 months from now. And, and we've been in this for from March to August is the same amount of time from August to January. And we've gotten, it's been this bad up to this point. We're going to move into a phase soon where the administration is either, you know, incapable of doing anything, or maybe after November, they're like, we're going to make this a nightmare for Joe Biden because that's their mentality. I mean, so is when we talk about looking at this, being conscious of the choices that we're making, is that going to make a difference in the context of what we're dealing with now? Like, I have no idea where we'll be in 5 months from now, but it can't be in a good place. And like, you know, like you say, right now we need 300,000 contact tracers. 4 months ago, we would have needed, you know, tens of thousands, maybe. Where are we going to be 4 or 5 months from now?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there, you know, what I still haven't completely wrapped my head around is what actually creates political will to deal with this in our current environment. And it seems to be when the ICUs are overwhelmed, like at the local level, right? Like at the federal level, it's, you know, I agree with what you're saying completely. But at the local level, at least some municipalities and states, once ICUs kind of reach capacity, that's when they start getting freaked out and say, okay, wait a second, like, let's do something. So, you know, I saw that in the state of Maryland, for example. And now I live in the state of Maryland. And so in the beginning, it looked like our ICUs were going to get overwhelmed. And so Governor Hogan said, okay, let's shut down, because that was something he did not want to see. He thought that that would look really bad for him and, you know, of course, be bad for the state. But now we have cases that are going right back up to the levels they were before. The deaths are going up right back to the levels they were before. However, we now have extra ICU capacity. So his response is, well, let's just keep on keeping on. You know, we don't need to change too much, or maybe just around the edges, because, you know, the ICUs aren't getting overwhelmed. So that seems to be the one thing that kind of makes municipalities act. Of course, by then it's like way too late to actually, you know, get in. The only thing you can do then is do the hard shutdown. And the hard shutdown is very costly. I mean, not just to the economy, but people lose their lives in the hard shutdown because, you know, you get a heart attack and you don't go to the hospital because you're scared to go. So you have all this kind of follow-on effect. And I think, you know, unfortunately, we're just going to have to muddle through with this, what we're doing now. I mean, to me, it's become like school shootings where everyone said it's horrible, it's horrible, it's horrible, but we're at a complete stalemate and we don't move forward at all, even as the problem gets worse and worse. And I think that's what we're seeing. And, you know, if we actually get a government in November that has at least the political will to do something about it, we can start to slowly dig ourselves out. But you're right, it's going to be a much bigger problem then. The one tiny silver lining to all this is, you know, every epidemic collapses at some point on its own, whether or not you do anything at all, because the pathogen just runs out of susceptible individuals. People have either got it already, or they had it and died, or they had it and survived, right? So we right now, probably 15% of Americans have had this thing, considering that, you know, if we take into account that probably 10 times more people have actually had it than are reflected in the numbers. That means around 10-15% of the population has had it. Once we get to, you know, 40-50%, then the virus doesn't even have anywhere to go, and you start to see a natural decline. And it's possible that we might get there, you know, sooner rather than later because of the chaotic way we're responding to this thing.
There's also been, and I don't know if this is outside your portfolio, but there's also been some suggestion that there is an existing immunity because people have had some form of a coronavirus in the past. Someone has pointed out that we've not seen any municipality, any state, any country that has had an over 25% infection rate, which is strange. You would imagine that maybe there'd be one place that would, you know, and maybe it'll be America. But it where things have been so botched, or, you know, the thing spreads like wildfire and you can't get over that rate. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is some municipalities where we do have, like, Corona Creams. They did an antibody study there, and it was like over 50% of people had antibodies. So, you know, that's approaching the level that you would need so that even if the virus is introduced into that community, it doesn't have enough places to spread. So it can't, you know, kind of burst out into an outbreak. So I think it is happening on cells. I mean, we're not doing very good tracking of this. So, you know, we're not doing surveillance studies. We're not doing, like, widespread antibody studies. So we don't really know. We're really so much in the dark with all of this. But at least on these, you know, when we focus in on certain places that scientists have done a few studies, it does seem like there is some places where that might be happening. I mean, this is a very, very cruel way to deal with a pathogen. When you have tools you can use against it, and yet you just, you know, don't use them and let a lot of people die to get to population immunity naturally, I mean, that's extremely brutal. And we'll have to live with sort of the moral implications of that for a long time. But I think it is possible that that is where we're heading to, and that in certain places in the country that, you know, we might already or be approaching it.
I want to get back to trying to anticipate how we're going to react to this when we are sort of on the other side of it. But let me ask you this question too. One of the things that, how much do you know about the transfer of data from the CDC to, you know, via the White House? When this was first announced in mid-July, people I spoke to were like, well, the CDC hasn't done that great of a job anyways, and most of the stuff we're relying on is sort of outside data. It's been pointed out to me, and I really don't know what to make of it, but coincidentally, around that day, around July 16th, 17th, when the data supposedly starts to move to the White House, we start to see a flatlining of, we're just putting up the thing right now. You can see this right around July 16th. It goes up to a peak, I don't know, maybe a day or two later on the 18th. And then it starts to flatline and even drop a little bit. And how much of that is, I mean, I don't know. I'm not in these states where things are expanding significantly, but I'm a little bit surprised that it had, you know, that at the beginning, you know, prior to July 4th in these places, people started to respond in such a, you know, in a more responsible way. I find that hard to believe. Do you have any sense of like what the implications are of that switch in the way that we were collecting data?
I mean, I'm very skeptical of all the data that we're looking at. There's a lot of ways in which bad actors can fudge the data. It's because contagious diseases are hard to track, you know, and that's been true for all the infectious diseases of our past. So it's not peculiar to coronavirus. On top of that, we have just sort of the fog of war and, you know, the chaos of this new thing that's overwhelming hospitals, and they don't know where to send their data, and they don't have the spreadsheets and the database isn't set up and all of that stuff. So, you know, and I think we have already seen a lot of evidence from the Trump administration that they would prefer the numbers to be different. And there's so many ways in which they can change things so that they are different. And you know, they've done that in the past with other disasters, like, you know, the way data is collected around, like, who dies from hurricanes or who dies from antibiotic-resistant bacterial pathogens. You know, there's all these ways in which our data on these things are politicized. And so I would be very surprised if there aren't some political influences on the data collection we're getting right now. And I think that move to take away the hospitalization data from the CDC and put it, you know, directly with the Department of Health and Human Services definitely stank of political influence. And my understanding is that, you know, they're justifying it as saying, well, we're trying to streamline it. But in fact, they've contracted it out to some outside company that is actually making more of a mess of it, at least for the time being. So I think the best data for me as a journalist that has been reporting on infectious diseases for all these years, when you look at a new pathogen, what you want to look at in the end is excess mortality. You know, deaths always go up and down in a predictable fashion just because of the age structure of the population. And you can see if there's more people dying during a certain period, whether they, you know, whatever they're dying of, you know, it's ultimately, that's the number to me that's going to really tell the whole story of how many people died who would have otherwise lived during this period. And we can see in excess mortality already that there's a huge spike. Right. You know, there's a huge spike starting in March, April, et cetera, and it's going on. I mean, excess mortality data comes out late. You don't get it right away. So this is something that's useful for looking backwards and seeing what happened. But, you know, I think given all this, you know, we saw, and even state by state, a lot of the state officials are trying to cover up or massage the data. CDC tried to massage the data on the testing when that was a whole stink. So, you know, all of our numbers are soft. And that's been true for every other contagious disease in the past also.
There is another metric, too, that seems incredibly soft to me that is I think, really problematic. And that is, we don't, everything, at least, you know, and I spend a lot of time reading about this stuff. All of my knowledge about the implications of getting this seem anecdotal in terms of the long-term or even the midterm health implications. I mean, I have a friend who, she got it in the first, right in the middle of March. And apparently she still doesn't have a sense of smell. I mean, that's 4 or 5 months out. That's a fairly long term, you know, issue. We're seeing there's, you know, you read an article here about there are heart damage, perhaps, even if you don't, you know, even if you thought you have recovered. I mean, doesn't seem to be any central repository that is tracking the health implications of people once they've recovered. You know, we have that number, right? This is how many cases, this is how many recovered, this is how many dead, this is how many active, but we don't have any sense of like the long-term. I mean, is it 1 out of 5 people have long-term complications? 1 out of 3, 1 out of 10? We have no idea, right?
Yeah. And I think we won't until this thing sort of progresses further. And that doesn't surprise me so much because, you know, when you have a novel pathogen, everyone's going to have an idiosyncratic response because as a species, we haven't encountered this thing before. So like in the past, we've encountered, you know, you can see this in our genetic changes that, you know, there'll be like the diversity of genomes around this one part of our DNA. And then a pandemic, a new pathogen comes in and basically wipes out a whole bunch of people who had a, you know, certain kinds of genetic sequences, and then you get this homogenization, and so then everyone has, you know, all the people who survive have a kind of similarity between them because everyone who is different, like, you know, didn't make it essentially. And so the fact that we're seeing a lot of idiosyncratic responses to this pathogen doesn't surprise me, because it is new. So there's going to be a lot of people who, you know, they're going to just have a response that's not the same as everyone else's. And, you know, characterizing that is very complicated, and it's going to take time for all of that to come out. So, you know, I don't think with any contagious disease, there's idiosyncratic responses. But for most of our pathogens, we all have some kind of immunity. At least, even if I didn't ever get this particular strain of flu that we get this winter, like my grandmother did, you know, because we've had these pathogens in our families like for generations. And that kind of weeds out certain sort of idiosyncratic responses because those people basically don't make it. And so that process is just starting now for us with coronavirus.
Okay. So lastly, let me ask you this, and it's probably a big question though, to make the last question, but you've written extensively about cholera and other, and Zika and Ebola. But I wonder if, you know, and one of the things in the reading that I've been doing over the past couple of months is, you know, sort of the one theme about the 1918 flu pandemic is just how much it seemed to have been erased from our, you know, our national consciousness. I mean, obviously, there, you know, scholars are aware of it, but, you know, I grew up knowing about the Great Depression and the Civil War. You know, the pandemic never really, you know, just sort of like maybe I heard it a little bit, but it wasn't a big topic. And apparently, you know, Wilson never even addressed it. And now I'm getting the sense of like, you know, in part why that is, because I frankly, like, I'm so sick of this that, you know, if we get to the other side of this and I never mention a single word of it again, I will be happy. But what do you, like, with what we're talking about, having seen the, and maybe it was because, you know, social sciences had not moved further enough, or maybe it was because during, you know, at least the last pandemic that this country had to deal with, we were still sort of in the wake of the discovery of the germ theory or the development of the germ theory, that there wasn't enough time spent on like the sociological implications of a pandemic. But what do you anticipate, like, what comes out of this when you start to talk about like the moral implications of the decisions that are being made here? Do you think that there is an opportunity for the real sort of like a real assessment of the sort of wellness of our society in terms of our ability to be resilient in what will inevitably be future pandemics? And if, you know, what folks like yourself and others have been saying is the case, we're going to get more of these because of the nature of how we are essentially gobbling up nature.
Yeah. I mean, talk about historical amnesia. Like, we've forgotten the 1918 flu until just now, but we also have forgotten that we have other pandemics going on right now. HIV was a brand new pathogen in 1982. No one had ever seen anything like it before, and millions of people got it. It is a pandemic. It is going on right now. People are still getting sick. People are still dying of HIV. So we still have a cholera pandemic going on right now, you know, just a few hundred miles off the coast of Florida and Haiti in the Western Hemisphere. We don't really think about those because there are drugs and vaccines, at least for wealthy people. So, you know, we don't even give them a second thought, as if those are risks in our lives anymore, because we don't, you know, we can get a pill, we can get a vaccine. So why even think about it? So, you know, it's true. We have forgotten the 1918 flu until now, but we've also forgotten these other pandemics that are actually going on right now besides the coronavirus pandemic. But in terms of your question, how will we emerge from this in the future after this whole thing collapses? My hope is that if we find out, if somebody can pinpoint that the reason why this virus spilled over into human populations has something to do with what I suspect, deforestation, which allowed bats to come into closer contact with humans and facilitate, you know, hunting and selling them for food and all the other things that, you know, humans do with bats that allows their microbes to come into our bodies. Those are all roughly implicated by deforestation, which is roughly implicated in our massive expansion of the industrial economy. That then we will start to see, like, okay, you know, these are things that we should have public health controls on. So that when the next mining company says, you know what, we want to set up, you know, this mine and cut down this part of the Brazilian rainforest, that it wouldn't just be environmentalists saying, no, 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 don't do that because there's all these special species in there and it's really important to us, et cetera. It wouldn't just be indigenous communities saying, no, this is where we've lived for a long time, like, you can't just cut it down. It would also be the global community saying, hang on a second, if you cut down those trees where the bats roost, they're going to come live in my backyard and my farm and my garden instead. And that's going to allow the microbes to live in their bodies to come into our bodies and make us sick. And for that reason, you know, to add that whole other level of reason, of justification to constrain industrial expansion, I think that would go a huge way to protecting the public health and the environment generally. I mean, obviously, these are problems that are implicated in a lot of the crises we face, not just right. the biological disaster of the pandemic, but climate change.
Right. I mean, this is all there's, you know, it's all part of, I guess, the broad umbrella of you need to include externalities in your calculations as to the risk reward scenario there, because you know when capitalism offloads the externalities and doesn't calculate them, and we don't realize that they existed until after the fact, that's when we all get screwed. Sonia Shaw, the book is Pandemic: Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. And your piece in the Nation magazine is Time to Tell a New Story of Coronavirus. We will link to both those at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half, where we will have fun with the analysis of the question, what happens when you pay people an unemployment benefit that is larger than their pay? How often do they decide not to go back to work because of that, as opposed to say, like, oh, I'll be risking my life? And then the other shocking thing is just like, how little tens of millions of people make.
Yeah.
Just broadly speaking.
The insistence on maintaining this ability to coerce labor by keeping people in precarity even through this pandemic, it really makes me look at the way this country's championed the unemployment rate for the time I've been alive, as if it's kind of the elites gloating about how hard they're working us. But I don't know.
For a long time, too, we were told that the natural unemployment rate was something like 7%, like that you couldn't get employment rate that was lower than that.
Yeah.
But you know, at one point, Greenspan had said something to the effect of like, our job is to maintain a certain amount of insecurity amongst the working class, maybe broadly. Yeah. I can't know exactly who he referred to.
Ryan Cooper also wrote a piece a month or two ago, citing a University of Chicago study using census data that found that the poverty rate decreased the most it has in recorded history since the 1960s.
When the unemployment insurance, the federal bonus unemployment insurance,
yes,
was distributed, yes,
insane.
Wow,
And the thing is too, is that like, even on the terms of those officials who are claiming they want to save the economy, this is the best thing you can do for the economy, is to put money in the hands of people who are going to turn around and spend it.
Mm-hmm. There's a conversation between Smathers, a Florida senator, I think, and LBJ that I remixed a song to. And Smathers is talking about how he had this, one of his donors for the Democratic Party back then was this grocery store sort of oligarch in the Southeast. And he's telling him, like, we can't have Goldwater because then people won't have money to come to my store and buy groceries. Like, I need that as a business
right.
center.
Right.
Exactly. And it's, and like, after all these years, we finally got the Goldwaters in charge.
Yep.
Well, it's one of those contradictions inherent to capitalism that, left liberal economic redistributive policy is designed to work against so that capitalism is not crushed under the weight of its own contradictions and it can keep going, right? Because on the one hand, the idea that the Republicans are having is if you cut off any kind of help, and if you impose enough austerity, workers will be forced to accept unacceptable conditions on the job, which right now includes a global pandemic, and they will not have any bargaining power. So they'll have to accept low-paying, unappealing work of the kind that is, you know, readily available still in this economy. However, if those jobs no longer pay enough for them to consume things and continue to buy the things they need to live and reproduce themselves from day to day and generation to generation, it's going to be bad for the economy in a number of ways.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, you know, like I don't know that the Republicans, because frankly, you know, it's not a contradiction. The first belief that you articulated is a flawed belief. I mean, like, yes, they want to certainly to have leverage and to, but in terms of protecting their economy, it's not going to work. Like it's not going to work. Paying people money in this situation is the only thing that's going to keep the economy afloat. And the suffering that is going to come in the wake of this, I don't think is going to be limited to just the great unwashed, as it were. But
no, I mean, it's going to have all sorts of ripple effects, and we're already seeing that. But the basic drive, the basic imperative that capitalists have is to, you know, get the maximum amount of work and surplus value out of people for the minimum amount of pay. And that is a drive that like there is some method to this madness that we are seeing. It's just, you know, one of the internal contradictions, one of the death drives in capitalism that all of this good left liberal government policy is designed to be a counter tendency against.
Right. Right. I mean, I would like to see more of that left liberal good government. I don't even think that the Democrats are even doing that, frankly.
Yeah, no, they're not.
I mean, Joe Biden came out yesterday with, you know, support for the Heroes Act, specifically mentioned the subsidies to COBRA, which is just, I mean, it's just, I'm sorry. That is not even left liberal good. That's not.
No.
That is just.
It's garbage.
I mean, the Republicans would have offered that had the Democrats not. And then the failure of the post office. The post office, I think, is a really big deal that is ongoing right now. I've had multiple conversations with people who are waiting on packages. I went to the eye doctor to try and get to some new glasses. And they're like, yeah, we get it. It's like going to be 3 weeks because the post office is not getting stuff. And they have, it's unclear to me if they are, or if this is like one of the twofers, like they're going to sabotage the postal service because it, they want to privatize it and sabotage it because they want to make sure that vote by mail cannot be executed properly. It's probably a twofer, but who knows? But we will talk more about all of this and more in the fun half. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show and we give you extra content and you make us all very, very happy. So if you're one of those people who do not have the resources right now, particularly in light of what's happening with the unemployment stuff, or but any for whatever reason, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have a little patience. We're way behind on this stuff, but we will hook you up. But if you are one of the people who do not have such financial concerns, please think about joining our supporters, as it were. Don't forget amquickie.com. You can find that on just about any device you have. It's free. Also, we got merch at the shop.majorityreportradio.com. Have we rolled out any of the Pause It line yet, Brendan?
We are in the final stages of design confirmation.
And that includes carpenter pencils.
That's correct.
For our huge carpenter contingency of woodworkers that listen to this program. So check that out. And as always, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Tomorrow, Nomi Key will join us, and you can check out her show right now at patreon.com/the Nomi Key Show or youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show. Check that out. TMBS, Matt, you can take in a couple of weeks off and then come back?
We're taking kind of a light, we're doing a light show tomorrow. We're going to do a Q&A. So tomorrow night at the normal time, 7 p.m., David and I will be taking questions and maybe Alicia Brooks too. But not a full show, but we'll be doing that. Yeah.
You can find at patreon.com/the Michael Brooks Show. And Jamie, the Antifada, what's happening?
Yeah. So this week we have a little boys chat because I went away for the weekend. Andy and Sean had on Jake Flores to talk about his new podcast, Why You Mad? And Theories of Comedy and Class War. They also had a very good interview with the writer for The Appeal and The Intercept, Tana Geneva. And she talks about, I'm just going to read this, the NYPD's permissive culture towards rapists and other abusers on the force. Unfortunately celebrated by humorous challenge coins and nicknames like the Ass Man. So she talks a little bit about her reporting she's done on that, failures of Cuomo and DeBunglio's even tepid reforms. And they speculate on why it's been so difficult to get this problem under control and whether defund or abolishing police and prisons is the right approach. So check that out, patreon.com/theantifada. It's out on Wednesday.
I think I read that report about the Ass Man guy. That's disgusting.
Yeah.
And Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover?
Literary Hangover, we'll get to that at some point too. I'm not sure when. Maybe tonight or tomorrow we'll do a stream, but I'm
not
sure.
It's summer. We deserve extended times off right now. Somebody wanted to just ask me on the IM, is there a betting site for Majority Report versus Pac-Man Drive? My money is on David. He is working multiple platforms. It seems like easy money.
Jesus. He's got the motivation and the business savvy.
He's got the business savvy. And the guy's got spreadsheets all over the place.
Exactly. He's got
folks. If you're listening to the show, go and subscribe to our YouTube channel because Ronald Reagan is creating a big stir with stoking the fires of a competition as to who will get to 1 million subscribers first.
He's the Don King of YouTube left channels.
Yeah, yeah. Did your parents ever sign you up for a 4K or something like that, and you just found out about it? Like, oh, after running this now? That's what I feel like.
No, my parents did not do that for me. I can assure you that. But Ronald Reagan's like the Bob Uecker of left-wing YouTube shows. And Bob Uecker, you'd have to go back to the, and I'm talking specifically the ads. He would start the fights between fans of light beer being less filling or tasting great. And that is, right. But in the meantime, I know for a fact that Pacman is worried that, that Reagan has started a battle between us. I think Pacman is ahead of us by at least a couple thousand subscribers. Is that right?
About 1,000.
I think 1,000, yeah.
Do we not have this up on the big board? We should have an ongoing tally. Well, there should be like right there should be right here. There should be a YouTube. Folks, subscribe to our channel on YouTube. Go and do that. It's completely free. And every time you do, a Ronald Reagan actually earns a pair of wings. So I'm going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.